This is Kathy bringing you the News Gazette for Thursday, the 13th of August. Starting with the front page today in the News Gazette, by the numbers. Illinois impact. Champaign County closes in on 100,000 total tests. Douglas reports third death in 3 weeks. For the first time in weeks, Champaign County hospitalizations were in single digits, 9, down 2 overnight, and both positivity rates were below 1.0%. 0.4 single day and 0.9 7 day. Champaign County, with an estimated population of 209,689, is on the verge of surpassing 100,000 COVID-19 tests. It reported 4,363 more on Wednesday, pushing its pandemic total to 97,669. A man in his 50s became the third Douglas County resident in 3 weeks to die of COVID-19, officials said. The man had been hospitalized due to complications from the virus, according to the County Health Department. Half of Vermilion County's 8 new cases were related to someone who tested positive on Tuesday. The new cases involve a preschooler, 2 residents in their 30s, 2 in their 50s, and 1 in their 20s, 40s, and 60s. Of potential shutdowns in certain regions, if numbers keep rising, Governor J.B. Pritzker said, "That's the last thing that's on my mind if I can avoid it. But the truth is that if we keep going in the wrong direction, we will inevitably get there." A report from the county clerk. Wrong return address on some vote-by-mail applications by Deb Pressey. Before you return your vote-by-mail application to the Champaign County clerk, better check the return address on the bottom of the form. Some voters have received applications in the mail with instructions to return them to Champaign County Clerk Aaron Ammons, but the address provided for the clerk's office includes the wrong zip code. The correct zip is 61802, not the one on the application, 61208. Ammons said that he and his office are aware of the zip code error, and he urged using the online vote-by-mail application on his website. It's much more efficient, he said. For those who have already received a vote-by-mail application with the wrong zip code, he said, it's a simple fix. A significant number of vote-by-mail applications have already gone out, Ammons said. He hopes most people who live in the community will notice the transposed numbers in the zip code and be aware that the correct zip code for that area of Urbana, he said. Ammons also said he's spoken with the postmaster and has been assured that even those applications addressed with the incorrect zip code will still reach his office, though it may take a bit longer. Vote-by-mail ballots won't begin to hit the mail until September the 20th. This is not going to stop someone from getting our ballot, Ammons said. He and his office are looking into how the error was made, he said. The clerk's office used a couple of vendors, one that created the application and another that mailed it, Ammons said. Local realtor Stephanie Pratt said she received 3 applications to vote by mail at her home with the transposed zip code, one for herself and 2 others for her mom and stepfather who moved out of state 4 years ago. She plans to return hers using the right zip, saying with the other 2, "Hey, they don't live here," she said. Pratt said she can understand mistakes are made, but this is a very important thing, and I would expect that organization to have the proofreader to make sure no mistakes are made. Voting for the upcoming election is already subject nationally to mistrust and controversy, she said. John Farney, a former Republican Champaign County Treasurer and Deputy County Clerk, who worked in the election division, posted one of the applications with the wrong zip code on Facebook and directed a comment to Ammons. "No excuses this time," he said in his post. "It's not a misunderstanding like everything else. It's not racist. You screwed up. Your name is on the letterhead. Take responsibility." Farney said several people shared the application with the incorrect zip code with him. "I have seen 4 of them so far with the wrong address on it," he said. Coronavirus response from Big Ten Athletics by Scott Ritchie. Financial picture remains unclear. Josh Whitman was already projecting a potential financial loss of $20 million for the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics in the 2021 fiscal year. That was a minimum. The total loss, the University of Illinois athletic director said last week, could quickly grow beyond that figure. Discussions of the financial implications of the COVID-19 pandemic on Illinois athletics came before the Big Ten announced Tuesday it would postpone all of its fall. The hope from the Big Ten and from Whitman in those sports can be rescheduled for the spring. It's just that a hope and not a concrete plan means the financial considerations haven't necessarily changed. Illinois still doesn't know how many football games, if any, it will play in a revised spring slate. The same is true for men's basketball games, with the fate of that sport still to be determined amid the ongoing pandemic. Whitman also said that even if football games are rescheduled for spring and the basketball season progresses in a yet unknown form, there was not a clear picture on what value those games would create for the Big Ten's television partners. "We do know it won't happen in the traditional sense, and it won't happen in the way that we expected it might in terms of a fall season," Whitman said Wednesday in another online meeting with media. "There's still, I think, a strong possibility we'll play football this year, and hopefully do it in a meaningful way that creates great interest from our fans and from the public. If we're able to do that, I think we'll be in a stronger position financially than maybe we expect." That potential means that Whitman is holding off on making any knee-jerk reactions. Wisconsin Athletic Director Barry Alvarez wasn't in a similar space Tuesday following the Big Ten's announcement, saying there would be layoffs in the Badgers athletic department. "I think if I were to throw any new numbers out there, they would be pure speculation," Whitman said. "We're going to continue to take this in a measured way. We've already instituted a number of aggressive measures to try and conserve resources and save costs. We'll continue to do that, certainly, but we're going to avoid trying to overreact before we get a better sense of what the rest of this year will look like." Illinois' initial cost-cutting steps the last 5 months have included a number of maneuvers. Staffing was addressed, with 11 open positions remaining unfilled and 15 others cut, Whitman said. He extended his initial pay cut from June for a full year and at a higher percentage, 10, now 15%. And the rest of the DIA executive staff is taking a 12-month pay cut at 7%. More staff changes could be on the horizon. Whitman said the picture isn't clear enough now to know for certain. The DIA had an all-staff meeting Wednesday morning to discuss the changes announced by the Big Ten. "I tried to find a fine line there," Whitman said. "I want to be reassuring to them. I want them to feel comfortable and stay together as we work through this as a group of people. But I also don't want to overpromise. I can't be in a position to promise them something I can't deliver. We've been transparent and forthcoming with them from the beginning, and we'll continue to do that." Whitman has said multiple times during the last 5 months that there are only so many levers to pull when it comes to making financial decisions. There's also a hierarchy to those levers, with options prioritized both in the amount of money that would be saved and the impact each respective change would have on the operational landscape of the DIA. "It's not a straightforward analysis," Whitman said. "Sometimes a line isn't direct from one point to the next, but we're trying to find the intersection of those two considerations. We're always looking to, best we can, minimize the impact on our student athletes and on their experience, but also recognizing at some point some of these changes will have impact on that experience," he said. "How can we try and make that as marginal as possible has been an ongoing effort from our group. It will continue to be a big focus of ours as we go forward." And also on the front page, auction of former building finds a buyer by Ben Zigterman. The former owners of the News Gazette found a buyer Wednesday in a socially distanced auction in the now empty former newsroom of the downtown building. Bids opened at the reserve price of $900,000 and stopped at $1.1 million, former publisher John Reed said, but the final sale price may differ once it closes within 25 days. He declined to say who bought it, but said he was pleased with the outcome. "I'm extremely satisfied with the results of the auction," Reed said. "I'm glad to see it going to a local buyer who we hope will continue to provide good stewardship in the downtown." The proceeds from the auction will be used to pay back News Gazette Incorporated's creditors, Reed said. "We'll be wrapping all that up over the coming months," he said. The News Gazette was sold to Community Media Group in November and moved in April to its new headquarters at 201 Devonshire Drive in Champaign. The building at 15 Main Street was built around 1912, and the News Gazette had been there since 1984. The 53,000-square-foot glass, granite, and marble structure was marketed by local broker Jill Guth and Colliers International, which ran the auction. This incredibly significant building in Champaign attracted multiple bidders today in a very robust bidding activity among multiple bidders, said auctioneer Mark Abood, a senior vice president at Colliers. A high bidder was identified. Certainly, we hope they have some exciting plans for the property. And from the top of the morning, Something to Get You Going Today by Vice President Jim Rossow. The story of 14-year-old Tristan Slade's first hole-in-one keeps getting better. The Monticello High School freshman aced the third hole at the par 3 course at Lake of the Woods in Mahomet during a golf camp on July 8th. The club was as important to him as the swing. He was using a wedge passed on to him by his late grandfather, Jeffrey Slade, an avid golfer who died of cancer on February 20th. "It was just like Jeff was with him," said Tristan's grandmother and biggest fan, Lisa Slade, who has been taking him to golf camps and lessons since he was 8. "We all knew it was special. There's more." On Saturday at the Mahomet Family Restaurant, family and friends surprised Tristan with a commemorative plaque celebrating the moment. It was presented to him by his great-grandfather, Bob Slade Sr. of Mahomet, who, with 5 career holes in one, knows a thing or two about golf. Tristan was as floored as when he saw the ball roll in the cup. "It was really, really great," Bob said. It was neat to see how pleased Tristan was. Urbana District to Go Remote for the First Quarter by Anthony Zillis. The Urbana School District will move to fully remote learning for at least the entire first quarter instead of just the first 2 weeks of school, which was the plan the district announced last week. In the midst of a sustained spike in COVID-19 cases in Champaign County, Superintendent Jennifer Ivory Tatum announced the new plan at Tuesday's board meetings, and the board passed the resolution. "Our community did so well for so long in containing the virus," Ivory Tatum said, "which is one of the reasons we were planning all summer that we would have some in-person time with the students, even if it was just a small amount, to get them acclimated to a remote learning environment at the beginning of the year. Those numbers have changed, and our situation in Champaign County has changed very quickly." Before the meeting, Urbana Education Association President Alicia Trezise said she hoped the remote learning plan would be extended to provide teachers time to plan along with peace of mind. "I think our plan is an excellent plan," Trezise said. "The Labor Day date, a lot of my union membership and a lot of parents are stressing that they would like to see it extended and get that consistent message. It really relieves the anxiety of rushing into, I've got to be really on point for remote and then I've got to be ready for hybrid. It gives them the chance to be really prepared for quality remote learning." Ivory Tatum said the district is working to provide Chromebooks for all students and to help families sign up for free or low-cost internet. It will also use 8 buses as hotspots. She also said that the middle and high school will open some large common space. Substitute teachers and others will likely staff those spaces, though Ivory Tatum said their number will be limited to allow the maximum amount of space for students. "If we can't have our regular school environment because of the risk, we can have 30 or 40 students spread out in a huge space like this," Ivory Tatum said. "I think we can do this safely." Ivory Tatum said last week that while teachers would work their butts off, remote learning would be hard. Board member John Dimmitt echoed her concern on Tuesday. "My biggest fear is that what little progress we made closing the achievement gap is going to evaporate very rapidly without support to the students that need it. So I appreciate this opportunity that we're providing to at least catch some of the needs," he said. And from the Champaign City Council, language updates to city code move forward. At its meeting Tuesday, the Champaign City Council moved forward in updating the city code to reflect changing language around gender and sexual orientation. If it formally approves the changes at a later meeting, sexual preference would be replaced with sexual orientation. The term transsexual would be removed, and gender identity and gender expression would be added to the city's ordinances on human rights and equal opportunity in purchasing. Councilmember Matthew Gladney said he supports the changes but wished they weren't necessary. "It's kind of a shame that this is something that has to be there, because that means then there's reason for it to be there, that people haven't been treated fairly and so need a protective class," he said. The changes would bring the city code in line with a Supreme Court decision this spring that said employees cannot be discriminated against based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. Because of that decision, Assistant City Attorney Jennifer Bannon said, "Even if we did not touch our human rights ordinance, we would still prosecute cases where there was an allegation that someone was discriminated against based on gender identity or gender expression." She said sexual preference should be removed because it is an older term and tends to imply more that sexual orientation is a choice or a lifestyle. We wanted to update that to include something that makes clear that sexual orientation is an inherent identity that deserves protection. Under the proposed revisions, transsexual would be removed from the city's definition of sex, intersex would be added, and a definition would be added for transgender. The new language would also be updated to align with the Illinois law and require all single-user restrooms to be open to all users. It would also make clear that anyone is allowed to use the bathroom that most closely aligns with their gender identity. And from the Champaign County Courthouse, woman whose arrest sparked protests facing new charges, by Mary Schenck. Additional charges have been filed against a woman who has become a cause célèbre for racial justice groups over her treatment by Urbana police 4 months ago. Alaya Lewis, 22, of Urbana, arrived at the Champaign County Courthouse early Tuesday for a status hearing on charges alleging that she punched, kicked, spit on, and resisted Urbana police officers who were investigating a shooting. She was met outside by several supporters demanding that the criminal charges stemming from her April 10th arrest on Colorado Avenue be dismissed. Inside, she was greeted with new criminal charges stemming from conduct that occurred on June 23rd, the last day she was in court on those battery charges. State's Attorney Julia Reitz filed one new felony and two misdemeanor counts that Judge Tom DeFonis read to Lewis: criminal trespass to residence, criminal damage to property, and disorderly conduct for filing a false report with the Department of Children and Family Services against an Urbana woman. Lewis's new attorney, Jeanette Samuels of Chicago, entered a not guilty plea. DeFonis allowed Lewis to go free on the new case. She was told to be back in court September 8th on both cases. In the new case, Reed said about 5:30 p.m. on June 23rd, Lewis and a man with whom she was staying went to the Urbana home of the man's sister. He stayed in the car while Lewis allegedly pounded on the woman's door and windows, demanding to be let in to collect property. The woman was inside with her children and nephews and would not open the door. The Urbana police report said that Lewis then went to the back door and walked in, reportedly carrying a box. She took a laundry basket full of clothes belonging to the resident, went outside, and threw a lawn ornament through the rear window of the woman's van that was parked in the garage. Lewis then left with her male friend and later left a voicemail message on the phone of a 12-year-old boy who was in the house telling him he was lucky that she, quote, didn't bust you in your blankety-blank face, blank, quote. The same message also warned that she would be calling DCFS on the female resident. About 5 hours later, the DCFS hotline got an anonymous call alleging that the woman's children had access to drugs and guns and had been hurt by the female resident. A DCFS investigator went to the woman's home the next day and found no drugs, guns, or injuries to the children, and no other evidence that they were abused or neglected. On Tuesday, Lewis' supporters were chanting, "We believe that we will win," as she entered the courthouse. They held signs and wrote messages in chalk on the courthouse plaza, calling for the charges against her to be dismissed and the officers involved to be criminally charged, and criticizing Reitz's wardrobe. Reitz told Samuels, the new attorney from firm of Schiller, Prayar, Gerard, and Samuels, that the same plea offer she made to Lewis's public defender, Matt Hamm, for a guilty plea in exchange for probation was still on the table. Samuels told the judge there was no need for a probable cause hearing in the new case. Meanwhile, the man that Lewis was with in April is set to be sentenced September 10th. Camarion Busby pleaded guilty in July to unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon. Coronavirus response. CU preparing additional measures for arriving students. Due to a production error, the opening of this story was omitted from Tuesday's print edition. With thousands of students arriving next week, Champaign and Urbana are preparing ways to mitigate an expected increase of COVID-19 cases. Former Urbana alderman and UI physiology professor emeritus Eric Jacobson modeled what the impact could be on Champaign-Urbana, and it's urging both cities to limit bars and restaurants to takeout and delivery for the next 3 weeks. Without those steps, his model indicates that 800 more people would otherwise be infected, 80 more could be hospitalized, and 4 more could die. Champaign Mayor Deb Finan and Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin said that they plan to announce new measures this week. Champaign is working with the University of Illinois, the City of Urbana, and the CU Public Health District on several measures that aim to mitigate the possible increased spread of COVID-19 following the return of students to the community, Finan said. These include additional measures addressing food and beverage establishment operations, large gatherings, and face coverings. Said Marlin, "We're working very closely with Champaign and the university to plan for the safety of the community when the students return." She said both Jacobson's model and the model for the U of I campus from physicist Nigel Goldenfeld and bioengineering professor Sergei Maslov make clear that certain steps will help reduce the spread of the virus. Jacobson said he used to oversee a program of epidemiological modelers when he was an administrator at the National Institutes of Health and has a very, very long history in modeling a whole variety of things and making mathematical models. "We've used pretty much standard epidemiological modeling tools," he said. His model indicates that once students arrive, there will be an influx of cases in the community before slowing down after about 15 days. His model assumes that students returning will have the same viral load as people across the state do, or about 9 times that of Champaign-Urbana. And he said that the model only assumes 1 round of testing and isolation by the U of I instead of the twice-weekly testing that students and employees will be required to take throughout the semester. "In the long run, we're going to be great. We'll be in good shape," Jacobson said. "It's just that this transitional period, when it hits us faster than the university testing and isolation response can kick in, that's the period that we've really got to worry about." He said he was initially worried that the community would lose control of the virus, but that does not seem to be the case. Goldenfeld and Maslov said they had talked with Jacobson about his model. "We agree that indoor bars and dining do cause transmission, especially in the early phase of the student return, before they evolve," Goldenfeld and Maslov said in an email, noting that they were not speaking on behalf of the U of I or its SHIELD team in charge of testing and tracing. Goldenfeld and Maslov's model projects that with the U of I's COVID-19 steps, fewer than 500 students could be infected over the course of the semester, with no more than 100 at any one time. "They don't believe it's necessary now to limit bars and restaurants to curbside pickup and delivery to keep the virus under control," they said. "But any extra steps that can be taken to reduce gratuitous transmission, and certainly before all the students have been tested and isolated, should be taken," in their opinion. And this is from Jim Day. State gives smaller communities the boot on aid issue. The big guys are picking on the little guys again, and the little guys don't like it. The question is what the little guys do about it. The answer, not much, came Tuesday when officials with the Illinois Municipal League faced off against the unyielding bureaucrats at the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity before a panel of legislators who oversee administrative rules. The issue, as it usually is, involves money, specifically federal legislation that appropriated $2 trillion in coronavirus assistance and to states and local governments. A portion of that $2 trillion was provided to Congress to provide aid to struggling businesses and cities across the state. But Congress also stipulated that the money was to be allocated through the states to local communities. The whole idea seems simple and clear enough, but the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity decided it had a better idea. Officials there decided that financial aid to struggling businesses would be provided to the City of Chicago, Cook County, and four collar counties, but not to smaller cities in the state like Champaign and Urbana. They decided that smaller communities could not be trusted to award grant funds in a responsible manner, an event that, if it occurred, would leave state taxpayers on the hook to pay the money back. Instead, the state plans to keep the aid money and use it as it sees fit rather than parcel it out to various city officials across the state so they can help their local businesses. The state's decision angers public officials like Urbana Mayor Diane Marlin. "The state should just get out of the way," Marlin said. "State officials don't see it that way." They met last month with the members of the General Assembly's Joint Commission on Administrative Rules, a bipartisan panel that oversees executive branch rulemaking. After listening to complaints about leaving smaller communities out of the mix, a move at odds with congressional intent, they diplomatically promised to review the issue but made no promises. They returned Tuesday with a proffered compromise that didn't violate the promises that they didn't make. They're still standing by their decision to cut out the smaller communities, but agreed to extend by 30 days communities' opportunities to apply for federal funds administered by the states. By not voting to reject the plan, legislators on the committee accepted it. Needless to say, that did not satisfy Illinois Municipal League Executive Director Brad Cole, who complained about the double standard. This removes local control from grants allotments and potentially renders tens of millions of federal dollars unable to be utilized, he said. What's allowed for Chicago and its suburbs is not allowed for other regions downstate. Governor J.B. Pritzker's office has indicated it hopes to provide other aid to businesses hurt by the pandemic. It's overseeing a $600 million business interruption grant program. It has also expressed the hope that more federal aid will be forthcoming if and when Congress passes another economic aid package. So far, however, Republicans and Democrats have been unable to agree on what should be in another aid package as well as how big it should be. Martin dismisses the state's claim that smaller communities are unable to responsibly oversee a grant program to local businesses. We can administer it, she said, noting that the Urbana used roughly $300,000 in special community grant money to help businesses there. Urbana's Small Business Assistance Program solicited applications for grants ranging from $1,000 to $10,000 and received 37 of them. Ultimately, it approved 28 of those with a total allocation of $252,020. 16 were for minority-owned businesses and 7 were for female-owned businesses. Among those receiving grants were the Rose Bowl, $9,970, Share Impressions, $9,000, Urbana Acupuncture, $10,000, Ashar African Market, $10,000, and Art Co-op, $10,000. I think it worked out really well, Marlin said. As circumstances now stand, neither Urbana nor other communities like it will have the chance to show whether they can or can't measure up to proper standards. The big guys aren't taking any chances on the little guys. And this editorial, court ruling just common sense. The public's business, no matter how or where it is conducted, should be open to the public. Public officials are a lot more supportive of the idea of sharing public information with the public in theory than they are in reality. That's why a recent decision by the First District Appellate Court in Chicago comes as good news. The court recently and unanimously ruled that the contents of public officials' private email and text accounts are subject to the disclosure requirements of the state's Freedom of Information Act. The reason that it's good news is not because the busybodies will be able to scrutinize the private communications of public officials and employees. It's good news because public officials and employees won't be able to shield their communications on public issues by claiming those communications are private because they were conveyed on a personal as opposed to governmental email or text account. As noted by Appellate Court Justice Cynthia Cobbs, there's an excellent reason why those communications cannot be beyond the scope of the Freedom of Information Act. Allowing public officials to shield information from the public's view merely by using their personal accounts rather than their government-issued one would be anathema to the purposes of FOIA, Cobbs wrote in an 18-page decision. This case resulted from a dispute between Chicago's Better Government Association and then-Mayor Rahm Emanuel. After Emanuel left office, his successor, Lori Lightfoot, took up his privacy claim. The BGA sought municipal records on lead testing conducted in the city schools after an initial test showed elevated levels in the drinking water at an elementary school. If that is not the public's business, it's hard to imagine what would fall under the rubric. Under the city of Champaign, the emails and text messages from officials who are in a personal possession of a public body with the meaning of the FOIA, Cobbs wrote. Accordingly, the communications that pertain to public business from the named officials' personal accounts are subject to FOIA. The court's decision for now, at least, appears to eliminate what many public officials hoped would be a massive loophole in the law, the use of private accounts to avoid public disclosure. That's a good thing, however much our public servants who claim to love transparency may dislike it. And with that, I think we'll close part one, and please stay tuned. Part two will begin in a couple of minutes.